Jerry Bader Show, 10:36. Before the end of the hour, I also need to discuss the media reaction to the latest document dump concerning John Doe investigation concerning Governor Scott Walker. Wall Street Journal yesterday afternoon online posted, I think, a spectacular piece dealing with the media reaction. However, before we get to that, as promised, we have an interview to get to. And before I bring the interview subject on, Jason wants to do something. Jason, go ahead. We are joined now on the phone by Wisconsin Congressman Paul Ryan. Congressman, good morning, and my producer wants to know if you recognize the song.
You got the Wisconsin Marching Band in there today?
No, that would be the... Oh, he's disappointed. It's the...
Well, I know it's not a UW song, but it sounds like the band. But no, I don't recognize the song.
You don't recognize the song? That is the Miami of Ohio fight song.
I was thinking that. I was going to guess that. Honestly, I was. But not quite sure. It's not one of those... You know, it's not like one of those school songs that really rolls right off the tongue, to be honest with you.
Well, I would agree with that. We'll give you a pass on that. Good to talk to you again.
Yeah, how you doing, Jerry?
Good, good. Obviously, we're going to talk about your book. I do want, in the time that we have, there are a couple of other things I want to get to, but we'll start with the book, and I want to set the stage for you here. In advance of the release of the book that did come out this week, The Way Forward, Renewing the American Idea by Paul Ryan, you had the piece in advance of that in the Wall Street Journal, and I shared that piece with listeners. And a fair number of them responded, I'm going to be honest, Congressman, negatively. What they're hearing from you is a call for pragmatism they believe they've heard before that resulted in conservatives compromising their principles to get along. You've said the purpose of the book is to show the country that we have better ideas, we being conservatives. We need to define ourselves as what we are in favor of just as much as what we are opposed to. What do you say to conservative skeptics, Congressman, who are convinced that they've seen this act, it involves compromising your principles?
Read the book, and you'll find out that's not what I'm saying. It's just that clear. What I'm trying to show is how if you apply conservative principles, specifically our founding principles, self-government under the rule of law, liberty, freedom, the Constitution, government by consent of the governed, that you, if you apply those principles to the problems of the day, we can get this country on the right track, we can fix our problems. And the point I was trying to make in that part of the Wall Street Journal is we need to speak to people more clearly who are not used to hearing from us, who don't think we care about them, or who, more importantly, haven't given conservatives a second look. You know why I say that? Because if we just preach to the choir, we will not win national elections. We need to have a conservative movement that is principled, aspiring, unifying, and attractive to and appealing to a majority of Americans so that we can win national elections, so that we can actually put these principles to practice. This is the concern I have, which is we're starting to run out of time. The liberals have had a good run. Look at the current administration. And if you don't like the direction the country's headed, which I don't, I feel as an elected leader that I ought to offer a different way forward based on these core principles that made me a conservative in the first place. And we have to widen the audience. We have to show that conservatism appeals to everybody and has better answers to our problems than the empty, hollow, false promises of big government liberalism.
Let's take an example. You point out that the phrase makers and takers was a mistake. Was the wording wrong or is the sentiment wrong?
The wording was wrong. And I, if you read the book, you'll see the sentiment. I say, look, there's clearly a culture of dependency and a problem with dependency on government in America today, but it's wrong to paint everybody with the same broad brush. You know, did I think of myself when my dad died and went on Social Security survivor benefits as wanting to be dependent upon the government for the rest of my life? No. We were struggling, we were striving, we made a difference in our lives. And so you have to respect the fact that there are people who are down on their luck, who are on the safety net, but who don't want to stay there, who want to get up. And if you try, if you use the wrong kind of language to malign people inadvertently, inappropriately, then you can disparage what they're trying to do, and they may not listen to your message of upper mobility, of individualism, of opportunity. And so, to me, it's very important that we try to broaden our appeal and bring our message to each and every person, because there are a lot of people who are struggling and striving to get ahead. And it's why I talk about welfare reform 2.0. It's why I talk about the kinds of conservative reforms to our safety net, to our welfare state, to our entitlement programs that are necessary to give people independent lives so that they can reach their potential. That's the point I'm trying to make, which is, if we just preach to the choir and the choir is shrinking, we're not going to win national elections, and the left will win by default. We have to expand our appeal, be careful on how we craft our message, and bring the idea of liberty and freedom and self-determination and self-government under the rule of law to people who just haven't heard the case, and show how it applies to their daily lives so that we offer real solutions, especially in this day and age, now that we see what big government in practice really looks like. Now that we see the false promise of Obamacare. Now that we see how our national security is compromised because of the kind of foreign policy of this president, now that we see the kind of debt that is plaguing our children and our grandchildren, we have to offer an alternative that people can come to.
Talking with Congressman Paul Ryan, his new book, you have made poverty, fighting poverty, a priority of late, and some of your critics argue it's an issue you've come to late in political life, perhaps out of expediency. Is this a new Paul Ryan, or did we just not know the old one very well?
No, it's the same old Paul Ryan, mentored by Jack Kemp. But what I've seen in this economy, since people have fallen so farther behind, so many middle-income people don't even find themselves in the middle class. I think what conservatism offers is a kind of healthy economy where it's not just a plan for just poor people, and then here's my plan for the middle class. That's what the left does. They speak to people as if they're stuck in certain classes and that the government's here to help them cope with it. What I'm trying to do is come at these issues from a different way as a conservative, which says, here is an economic vision of vitality that speaks to everybody, especially those who are on the bottom rung of the economic ladder, and that these are principles and solutions that produce a healthy economy so people can get opportunity and get up with their lives. People who are in the middle income who are still struggling, they're worried about going into poverty. People who are in systemic, multi-generational poverty want to know that there's a way out. Only through conservative, free enterprise economics that really produces a dynamic, inclusive economy so everybody can participate in the economy and find opportunity can we really realize the American idea. That's why the subtitle of the book is Renewing the American Idea. What is that? It's the basic idea that the condition of your birth does not determine the outcome of your life in this country. We are the land of opportunity. We're based upon a system of self-government with the rule of law. And if we revitalize that whole concept, everybody, no matter who they are or where they are, what condition they find themselves in, can get a better life.
You told Bob Schieffer this week you'd like to see Mitt Romney run for president again. Seems unlikely. 4 million Republican voters went missing in 2012, yet you still believe at least a Romney-type candidate is a winning template for Republicans in 2016. Why?
Well, I think we made some mistakes in 2016. That's what the book is in part about, and how we have to run national elections much differently. So I talk about that. But the reason is because Mitt Romney's a good man. I think he's a very principled, very honorable, a man of great character and a very good temperament. And so I think he would make a fantastic president. And I think a lot of people just didn't get to know him the way those of us who really do know him do. I think the Mitt documentary kind of revealed that after the campaign a little bit. I think he predicted a lot of the problems that we're experiencing now as a result of Obama. He was pretty clairvoyant in those points. But, you know, he says he's not running, so I guess it's really not a point worth really debating. But I do make some arguments in this book after the lessons of 2012 about how we cannot repeat the mistakes that were made, how we have to build a majority coalition, and how we really need a real choice-based election to give the country a crystal clear choice about what kind of country they want to have, so that if and when we win that kind of an election, we have the ability and the mandate and the moral authority to save the country before it's too late.
just about out of time, but I do want to get this question in. I want to deal with the very serious threat that most people seem to see, who discuss national security and ISIS, ISIL, and that the president took it lightly for too long. I think you go even bigger than that, Congressman. We're in a position now where we might have to try to make some type of an ally out of Bashar al-Assad to deal with this problem in Syria. Your overall analysis of the way the president's handled this and what you would like to see that you haven't.
He made critical mistakes in Syria, fundamental mistakes in Iraq. Those mistakes, in large part, gave rise to the situation we find ourselves in. My assessment of his current policy is he's just reacting. He's containing. What I would like to see from the president is a strategy to defeat and finish off ISIS, not simply to react to ISIS. As far as Bashar al-Assad, I don't see him. We should never see him as an ally. Perhaps in the short run, he would benefit from us finishing off ISIS, but all the more reason why we need to work with the Free Syrian Army, the moderate elements in Syria who want just freedom, who don't want to export jihad and fundamentalism. And, you know, the problem is the president had a better chance a couple of years ago of really affecting the trajectory in a smart way. He whiffed on that, missed it, just like he did in Iraq. But it's still, in my opinion, probably not too late. The thing with ISIS is they've got money, they know what they're doing, they have an apostolic end-of-world kind of vision, and they have territory. And we know where they are. And they have, oh, by the way, perhaps a couple of thousand passports, foreign passports. So we know where they are, we know the threat that they pose, and it's in a phase of their development where we ought to get them now before it's too late.
Quick 15-second follow-up. Rick Perry was ridiculed for pointing out that our porous southern border created a threat of ISIL, ISIS coming in that way. Is he right?
Yeah. I mean, having not controlling who's coming and going in your country means you're exposing yourself to a terrorist threat. And the southern border is one of the biggest parts of it. That's why I voted for the border bill in July. That's why I voted to give Rick Perry reimbursement for sending the National Guard down there.
All right. And with that, we are out of time, and I want to stick to your schedule. Congressman Paul Ryan, thanks for joining us.
Thank you, Jerry.
Appreciate it. It's doing a lot of interviews these days, as you might imagine. We were given 10 minutes and we took about 12. So I didn't want to hold them any longer than that, and I do appreciate it. I actually don't have time to follow up on that because I do need to get to the Scott Walker thing. Maybe tomorrow I'll expand a little bit on what the congressman had to say. 10:48.
The Jerry Bader Show.